Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast. Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Law of Code podcast. This is part two of my conversation with Eric Hess to discuss his paper, Bridging Policy and Practice, A Pragmatic Approach to Decentralized Finance, Risk, and Regulation, where he overviews the history of securities regulation, starting hundreds of years ago, to today's approach to DeFi, as well as what future approaches could look like in a way that marries the main issues identified by regulators, such as AML concerns, with the promise and the benefits that this technology provides. If you haven't heard the first part, I highly recommend listening to that. I'll put a link in the show notes below. As for now, this is part two with Eric Hess. Eric, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me back.
So let's just start with a quick question around the history of securities regulation. And we spoke about a pretty exhaustive history, but I'd love to hear something that you think most people aren't familiar about when we talk about the history of securities regulation.
Well, I think one thing that was picked up on after our episode was that it was my discussion regarding what the underlying purpose for the 34 Act was and what drove it. And that it was ultimately about protecting the financial industry, and that investor protection, while important, certainly critical in the 33 Act, et cetera, it was really a means to ensure the protection of that industry. You needed investor confidence to ensure a stable financial industry. It raised all boats, but you have to, like, it was really important. It's really important to understand that intermediation was a result of protecting the financial industry at a very critical time for them, where there were rug pulls. There were bad things. There's always been fraud. There's always been manipulation. It was, in the light of the crisis that the country faced, it was even more critical to right the ship. But the decision was made to protect the industry, and by setting up a framework that was based on intermediation, it was really designed to ensure that they continue to have that critical place. And it just, I'm not saying it was wrong. I'm saying the tools then were much more limited than they are today. And we don't have to adhere to the current balance that we face. We can look at the tools that we have and make the decision about how to craft it. We don't have to be stuck in the historical view of intermediation. And there is some, particularly when that intermediation has some other limiting factors, particularly when you think about like global financial exchanges or global interactions or borderless technology, a term we often use, almost like we become so accustomed to using it, saying it's borderless. But what is borderless, and how important, what can borderlessness achieve? And that's a global financial system. That's a global system that's based on code and immutability. And in not all respects does it require humans. I'm not saying get rid of them. I'm saying let's think about the right balance and think about the tools that we have at our disposal and not be stuck in the past. The other thing that another thing that I was thinking about, I felt like it was very important that the relationship of the SEC and regulators with technology and how it was so supportive and this symbiotic relationship and how that all changed post-2008 and even before 2008. It's not just 2008, but there were some key changes that altered that balance. And I think in a way that has perpetuated since 2008 and even a little bit before, but obviously exacerbated by 2008.
Thank you for sharing that, Eric. Let's move into the decentralized finance space. And I wanted to start with the 2022 White House Executive Order on Ensuring Responsible Development of Digital Assets. And that was tasked to the Financial Stability Oversight Council, so FSOC, and their goal was to identify the risk that digital assets posed and propose necessary regulatory adaptations. How did this White House executive order come about, and why was FSOC the one tasked with this?
Well, with regards to FSOC, FSOC was created following the part of the Dodd-Frank Act. 10 voting and 5 non-voting members. You're headed by the Treasury, you have the FDIC, Federal Housing Finance Agency, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You have, of course, the SEC, you have the CFTC. And the idea was, is like, hey, by getting these people together, coordinating on it, they can better limit systemic risk. Initially, they were focused on automated trading. High-frequency trading was another one. And of course, digital assets. FSOC is focused on systemic risk, right? So it's the risk to the whole financial system, particularly when DeFi was growing, it was much more of a focus. Now, when it comes up, it's more about hypothetical systemic risk. Like Commissioner Romero from CFTC has even spoken about the need to think about, should we regulate for hypothetical systemic risk? But I think in 2022, this was pre-FTX, this was before Terra Luna, and I think it was, how do we get our hands around this? How do we do something? I don't think there was ever an embrace of digital assets, but you know, the White House executive order, I think, was a step to try to move it in a direction that the White House, that this administration believed was the correct one. And they charged FSOC, and they drew on FSB for risk management. They charged the CFTC and SEC to work together. The FSOC has an annual report where they review these risks, and they make recommendations for the actions that then are fed into the actions of the regulators themselves. While CFTC is specific, has more than part of its mission is to manage that risk. It's a little more prominent for the CFTC than the SEC. The SEC has also taken it up. Chairman Gensler has referred to it on a number of occasions, just not to the same extent that I think the CFTC has.
And so what have you seen happen since they were charged with this task?
Well, for starters, I think FSOC has resulted, or maybe has been an impetus for more of these agencies to work in concert and to try to approach it from a similar perspective. Having said that, the CFTC and the SEC seem to be almost vying for this territorial issue at different times. It has different intensities. But FSOC was prominent in driving a lot of early action and encouraging, basically supporting more stringent AML, more stringent enforcement. It was basically the regulators got together and all reaffirmed their own biases toward regulating more, right? But, you know, in terms of what the FSOC has done since 2022 on this, I don't think they've done a lot because DeFi's TVL has dropped. And I do think that there is a perspective that while the potential systemic risk for DeFi still exists, unless you're the CFTC and Christine Romero, maybe some others at the CFTC, quite honestly, the systemic risk component of it is a little more in the future. And there are things that need to be, in their perspective, things need to be done. And of course, you see Senator Warren going crazy to make sure of it, but you don't see systemic risk coming out of her mouth. Now it's like, now the focus is Hamas. So just label the whole spaces being associated with Hamas and terrorist organizations and the like. I know that's a gross generalization, but you see some of the stuff that's being said these days. It's like in an attempt to kind of keep this on the front page and to keep the pressure on, I think that Senator Warren and a lot of that crowd that circles around her has been really focusing on that. So systemic risk isn't coming up in that context, but systemic risk is far from dead. Like once we do resolve or put to rest some of these other concerns, systemic risk will continue to emerge and reemerge as an issue. And I think one of the things that I tried to do in the paper or in the article is to highlight, you know, that post 2008, this focus on systemic risk, not just for digital assets, but for all emerging technologies, really became much more of a focus, and it changed the way we approach regulation, and it changed the way we approach these technologies. And what emanated from that was our approach toward automated trading, our approach toward HFT, our approach toward digital assets, next, our approach toward AI. All these emerging technologies, the US's approach to regulating all these technologies is influenced heavily by 2008, and that aversion to systemic risk that sort of created this top-down mentality for regulation. And so that's what the article is really trying to say, this top-down approach, particularly as you're trying to go across technologies, it's a failed approach. And you're seeing the strains of it, and a much smarter approach would be to think about bottoms up. How do we build those bridges, really focus on implementing things that we can that are achievable and building from that versus something that's top down that's inevitably going to be broken by the time it's rolled out and is going to be imperfect.
And I thought your paper did an excellent job outlining how a bottom-up approach could look and how it's worked in the past and using historic examples. And so I highly recommend getting to that. But and we'll speak on that as well. Looking through your paper, I really liked how you had a David Deutsch quote that, about rational optimism. It's not just the belief that things will get better. It's also the understanding that we have the capability to make things better. This is the key to progress. When we solve problems, we create new problems, but they are better problems. They are the problems of success, not failure. And I thought that was a perfect quote for a paper like yours, where you're saying, hey, look, there are new problems that have emerged because of this technology. First, I just want to talk about what the US is doing. And one example is the scope of a communication protocol system in the 2023 supplemental proposal. The SEC appeared to indicate that virtually any party that develops or maintains a protocol or a code that facilitates the exchange of digital assets would be required to register with the SEC, and they would classify them as either an exchange or an ATS. And you write that that's notwithstanding the lack of regulatory clarity with respect to how this would be possible or whether any particular asset transaction would be appropriately characterized as a security transaction. And the reason the latter part is important is because that would bring it within the SEC's jurisdiction. But I'd be curious for hearing why it is not possible to register with the SEC as an exchange or an ATS in many cases of DeFi, or if it's maybe not impossible, but it's so unrealistic given the costs and the time required for these platforms.
There's a combination of factors. I'll be honest, I haven't tried to register an exchange with the SEC. I don't think I'd get very far. There's like a chicken and the egg problem in the US, and going after the exchange is an interesting approach because, like, if you go after the exchanges, then what brokers can trade on those exchanges? And what can those brokers trade? So, and there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to doing it. It just seems to be like just give you an impossible situation. So who's going to be on the exchange? Big question. What are they going to trade? Big question. And by the way, ATSs, exchanges, who's going to clear it? What? Clearing? What do you mean clearing? Right. Yeah, oh, yeah, you have to have transfer agents and all this other stuff. Well, that doesn't always work. And oh, what about the fact that it's global? No. You have to know how many holders have it in the U.S. and it has to be within the U.S. But it's a global instrument. So how do you manage that? And how do you surveil for manipulation? Do you have a responsibility across the entire world? Like, what's your exact role? And like, if I went through an exchange process, I was the general counsel for DirectEdge. DirectEdge became part of BAS. BAS became part of Cboe. Right? That's the way it goes, right? But it is an arduous process. There is you have to address all aspects of your business. And by the way, you also have to address things like NMS and routing of trades and best execution and all this other stuff. And how does that work? So none of these questions have been answered. And to just simply say, oh, well, you have to be an exchange. It's like, wow, there's NMS, there's reporting, there's surveillance, there's manipulation, there's how you're onboarding clients, there's who your clients. Like, it just goes on. So, like, you do have some, like, for the ATSs, there does seem to be some more, liberalization, but it's not even clear. For example, unless you're, like, a listed stock or Reg A+, you don't even have a state law exemption. So you still may have to register at a state level. So all these different tokens, they wouldn't even be able to trade unless they're addressing Blue Sky, which I don't know how many are well positioned to address Blue Sky. And considering that they're global instruments, it doesn't even work. And so what, are you going to have a central clearing party for all the crypto in the United States? That doesn't make much sense. I don't think the current regulation is designed for a global instrument. It's designed for what's within a border, like transfer agents, clearing agencies. Broker dealers have good control location where they have to be able to, from a bankruptcy perspective, it can't be bankruptcy remote. So how do you do that with crypto? So listen, if you have an equities, if you have an ATS, it's just hard enough to get approved to be an ATS, or God forbid, you decide to become an exchange. Like, that's really, really hard. If you have equity securities, that's really, really hard and really, really hard to maintain. So good luck with a digital asset exchange. But anyway.
When we say it's impossible to register for this project, it doesn't mean that it's not possible for the founders to register an exchange with the SEC or an ATS. Like, that's possible. It's not possible to maintain the project that they intended to build and go through this registration and adhere to all the requirements under this licensing regime.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at even some of the experiences with Reg A+, and the projects, the securities projects themselves, some of the projects that went through that initially, like Hero, I think was a Stacks, BlockStack. And then there was, I'm blanking on the other one, there's been a couple. But in both cases, neither was particularly successful. The reporting requirements were not very difficult because you had to have things with a board and the considerations, and there was all these types of liability concerns associated with your determinations. And so it just became too difficult. It just was poorly suited. And I think instead of just, I mean, I think that was an opportunity for the SEC to say, listen, how do we, like, we don't want to let these people off the hook, but maybe we need to experiment. Maybe we need to think of ways, like, we are entering in, technology is not regressing, it is moving forward. This is something that is not going to go away, even though we hope it will and hope that we can scream it down, which isn't the best basis for discussion. But it's not going away. And these are problems. And how do we make things more? How do we continue to grow? We can take baby steps. But, you know, in the absence of taking any steps and then saying, well, you have to register as an exchange or as an ATS, it's like dumb. Like, your office is closed. Like, hey, can I, excuse me, knock, knock. I have a question about this new, I'm sorry, we're not talking to you, but I will send you a Wells notice. So you'll be expecting that in the mail. What did I do? I don't know. I was just going to sue you. Okay. Let make it easier. Just go away. We don't have good answers. Like, well, that's not. So like this, the article that I wrote is really trying to think about how do we get there without even saying this is the SEC or the CFTC for it. It's just simply saying, like, if we're going to progress, we have to take a bottoms up approach, because what's the alternative? Like, where else do we go? Like,
yep.
So ultimately, we have to get there. It just how long we deny it, how much pain, what we do, how we fare against the rest of the world, all those types of things. But it is what it is.
Yep. We're back, just switching the audio here for part 2 of part 2 of the conversation with Eric. Let's talk about the same risk, same rules philosophy. So core of this approach, which is invoked in the context of regulatory policy, is an argument against any change. However, if such an approach had been applied to equities markets in the 70s, the NYSE would have maintained monopoly power, since no other market center would have been permissible. And that's from the paper that you have written. Can you discuss why this philosophy? It seems like such an easy, obvious philosophy, same risk, same rules, but you make a great point about how that is an argument against change. Why is that the case, and why is it ultimately a misplaced and misguided sentiment?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's a very convenient nursery rhyme, right? It avoids asking the more challenging questions about, are the risks the same? Are they truly the same? Should they be weighted the same? Which is really critical. And I think that's really where it goes askew. I mean, if there are the same risks, but they should be weighted differently, then why would you apply the same rules? And then at the end, it's added same regulatory outcome. Now, I often think the way that this nursery rhyme is applied is it just sort of really de-emphasizes the same regulatory outcome. It basically says you define the risk as the same, then you apply the same rules on top of those risks, and then that's how you get your outcome. I don't think there is really a thoughtful approach. Like, the thoughtful approach says, where are we winning? Where do we want to go? And then how do we get there? There are certainly unique risks to DeFi, which I talk about in the paper, but instead of taking this top-down macro-level approach that we have to sort of apply it across the whole system, I take it from the bottoms up. Because whenever these macro risks are identified, it also provides you an opportunity to take those same risks and flip them on their back and start from the bottom and say, how does this apply within an organization? How do we mitigate these risks within an organization of the risks? And in the paper, I sort of use this example of Riverview and River Bottom, which is in many ways a departure from a lot of the other techniques I use in the paper. But I felt like it was so critical, and it was a simple analogy of like, if there is a risk of flooding, you could have flooding risks in Riverview, which tends to be higher than the river, versus River Bottom, which is obviously probably lower than the river, right? So you're bound to get greater risks, but the nature of those risks might be very different. On Riverview, there might be flash flooding, whereas with River Bottom, maybe that slow accumulation of the water, and how you address that risk can vary dramatically. Now, again, I'm using a very simplistic example because I'm underscoring the complexity of just using a simplistic nursery rhyme, right? So there's many ways that you could offset the risk of flooding or water. But if you over-index on trying to fix the flooding, for example, and I use the example, like River Bottom, it may make sense to build those houses up on stilts, right? Or have them raised off of the ground. People are like, God, is Eric really going down this road? I'm done with this example already. But you build a house off the ground at the bottom. But yet, if you did that with Riverview, if the wind shear is much more significant because it's higher, then that could be weakening it. And furthermore, by over-indexing on the risk of flooding in a Riverview, you could be not addressing other things, like, for example, the wind, and how do you make the house as strong as the wind? And so to say same risk, same rules, particularly for something like DeFi, it's just sort of, it's ludicrous. Again, what it really means is I don't want to look at the differences. I don't want to look at the change. I want to apply the same rules because I'm identifying the same risk. It's not same risk, figure out the risk weighting, same rules. It's no, get the same risk, same rules, and then same regulatory outcome. But the distinctions and how you get there is very important. You can tailor, like particularly like regulated entities, they have very developed risk management processes. And I'm not saying give it all to the regulated entities. I talk about how there are other entities that could also have this expertise. But again, if we're thinking about sort of broader mainstream or institutional adoption, believe it or not, they're trained. They have very developed risk management processes that FINRA, for example, mandates on other broker dealers, that FIA mandates for all their registered members, right? So in each of those cases, they have very developed frameworks. These frameworks could be applied to these protocols. Now, these frameworks tend to be geared toward outsourced providers, so where you, again, have somebody who you can shake and touch and throw to choke. But these same types of risk weightings and analysis could be applied to assess the risks of the individual protocols. Again, the vision is largely a hybrid model, but you retain the truly DeFi protocol would remain truly decentralized.
Even same risk itself is a bit of a misnomer, because when you think about the risk in a case of DeFi, for example, compared to traditional finance, let's just say a lender agreement, sure, the risk is the same from a 10,000 foot view in things like a margin call or a fraud, but the risk itself is enormously different, just like it's different in different countries, just like it's different in different legal arrangements, depending on the entities. So to say same risk and have that as a blanket statement is dangerous in the sense that it's too simplistic. That's not the case. It's not the same risk. One is a smart contract on the Ethereum blockchain. The other one is a bank in the US. That makes a huge difference. And I think your example is a good one about the river and thinking through all the different parameters that go into what you're looking at.
Right. And I think a lot of the regulatory approach, particularly like even the CFTC, you see it with IOSCO, that was largely influenced by the SEC. IOSCO is very much basically the DeFi report, the principles that IOSCO published. That working group was led by the SEC. The CFTC was on it. It reports up to the Singapore MAS Authority, who's been trailblazers in some respects, but there is a bit of an echo chamber, just like often crypto is accused of being in an echo chamber. There's an echo chamber amongst the regulators. And one thing that generated a lot of controversy in that report was not only, basically, it was this model. Find the person. If you have an entity that's operating in this ecosystem, then find that entity, and there is a regulatory approach to be applied to them. So identify all the parties and then take an enterprise level approach. And you see this in what the CFTC recently published, their TAC report. You see this in the IOSCO, is this view to sort of superimpose this enterprise view. Now, the hybrid finance is as sort of envisioned in the paper, I guess at some level it would facilitate some of that, but draw the line at the DeFi protocol itself, because there could be a whole ecosystem around it. Some of it, maybe, but it wouldn't apply the sort of unitary view across the entire ecosystem right down to the DeFi protocol. Because once you eliminate that core, DeFi is gone. And you've lost all the benefits. You've lost the ability for multiple jurisdictions to interact with it. You can have multiple jurisdictions superimpose their own regulatory schema within the ecosystems that interact with it, I suppose. And we can debate about the wisdom of that. But fundamentally, the DeFi core itself, you lose the ability for a lot of the inherent conflicts, all the benefits and censorship. I mean, it is a utility and it should be preserved as such. And maybe it has functionality that would permit interactions amongst, for example, verified credentials, but not necessarily mandate it, not endeavor to sort of impose a mandate on this really borderless technology. For many of us who've been in crypto so long, we sort of lose sight of the fact we're so deep into the weeds, but it's truly an amazing borderless, doesn't require an intermediation. And once you close that off, once you close the ability for those interactions to occur without the intermediation, without the censorship, without the government super, without requiring an entire state mandated infrastructure, it's like, then it's underground. And that's not a world, I think, that's not the promise of what the technology offers. So,
well, let's talk on solutions, because I thought your paper did a great job of thinking through not only these are the issues, this is the history, but what could the future look like? And one thing that I know you're not the first to propose it, but I think you did a great job explaining it, and obviously a very novel points made, is the hybrid finance, right? A service that integrates DeFi on public blockchains with various controls and as a way to address AML concerns, particularly as those are important and not going away. And as we were discussing prior to recording, it's continues to be such an important area of crypto is AML concerns. So what could you discuss that model for hybrid financial services that could integrate DeFi on public blockchains with controls encoded?
Yeah, so the paper takes this very historical approach, and then I felt the need to try to take the history and the arguments into that next step. And like, what are some solutions? And what should regulators be working on? I didn't want to just be another one that said, oh, here are all these problems, or be a reporter on the state of the state, right? And so obviously AML is the elephant in the room. I actually spent a lot of time putting together a diagram of how it would work. It would be a combination of basically verified credentials, which is in many ways what Maas proposed, where you have it does require a trusted anchor to verify these credentials. But if that could be in a database, and that database could be accessed via zero knowledge proofs, then you could have different standards for different types of interactions on DeFi, and it might be a requirement in any particular jurisdiction for certain types of activities, but not all activities require the same level of KYC. And I kind of went through what Aave Arc, where they tried to have a non-regulated entity to do it initially. And I think there was some issues around the standards. And the fact of the matter is that some of these institutions may actually have more rigorous standards than what a lawyer might tell their client they need to have. And basically, you kind of need to be able to support all of that, I think. And parties could elect to which standard they wanted to confirm through zero knowledge proofs. And there's a lot more talk about that. I don't know if there's as much rubber hitting the road on that, but it's certainly a model that, like, particularly like, you know, in the US, that if we got out of our own way of continuing to deny the existence of the power of blockchain and try to push it all into institutions 100%, then we could make some real progress and also really democratize this type of AML
provisioning where it doesn't have to be so concentrated and you don't have to put your copy, your same credentials in a bazillion different places. Yeah. So you could have some trusted anchors. And then, but the BSA doesn't necessarily always require that level of KYC. In other cases, there's T or Know Your Transaction, where you're doing a search of the historical record that's on chain. That's what like a chain analysis or TRM or number of others do, and they could do that tracing of the activity, and then by interactions, again, I don't know how many hops, but if it goes back and identifies an old address, then that might be blacklisted and try to basically manage your interactions based on the interactions of the wallets you're dealing with. Now, some people would say, well, that's not always fair. But there's methodologies, and those methodologies could also be, there'd be some flexibility in those methodologies as well. So a combination in the AML sense, there could be a combination of verified credentials with a trusted anchor. There's also been talks about like KYC NFTs in a wallet. That's where, and again, whether or not the wallet providers or the decentralized entities that are providing the wallets really want to get involved in that is a whole different question. But if you made the regulatory scheme a little more friendly and not so geared toward the historical equity fixed income structures, then maybe you'd get some positive results to accommodate some of the innovation. So that's one area. And then some of the other areas that could be part of this ecosystem is, as I mentioned before, risk management and assessment. These are areas that regulated entities in every jurisdiction, they have responsibility for on some level. And maybe there's some that don't. Certainly in Europe, certainly in the US, if you're a regulated entity, you have to comply. It doesn't have to be restricted to the regulated entities, but that experience is there. So I don't know why we would want to reinvent it and try to propose this whole new schema that lays on top when there is a process for risk identification. That's something that like FINRA has very explicit guidance on, as does the FIA. You have to identify the risk. You have to weigh them. You have to go through this whole process of conducting this on your outsourced vendors. This is like your outsourced vendor. It's just an outsourced service. And so, and again, in an effort to try to take this a little bit to the next stage, I looked at a lot of the, obviously, like Aave and Uniswap and Curve and Maker, all those protocols have, you can find a fair amount of documentation that really provides like a lot of support for the audits that they've conducted and how they approach security and the like. And so those can form the basis of a benchmark that other protocols could align to. And that could, if you could infuse that, you could start to develop some standardization. I think people talk about that, but until there's like a sign-off that regulators say, if you do this, then this, then why would people do that? Why would people put all the time into developing these AML solutions? Why would people put all the time in developing these risk things? It's like, unless you provide an environment where it's not so much risk to do this, like you could put all this time saying, we're going to try to create this thing that is compliant with what we think the US would think is okay. And then the US comes in like they did with Coinbase and spanks them because they were trying to do the right thing. And again, I'm not suggesting that the government is all evil and Coinbase is all Mother Teresa and the like. But my point is that if you look in terms of the different cases, it is pretty, it's hard to imagine that the government actually worked with Coinbase and Coinbase endeavors to do this, and yet they don't even get an avenue to do that. I know I'm going a little bit off track, but the point being is that with the right incentives, with the right outreach, if the SEC can find a way to establish more credibility and more trust that there could be a basis for an exemption that like, hey, we can work with these protocols and we can find ways to do these things within hybrid finance. And if you do engage through this hybrid finance model, we're not going to come after you and start levying harsh fines against you. And then, yes, there's the AML, there's the risk management and assessment. And then the last thing that I talk a bit about in the article is this notion of pre-transaction risk analytics, which you could apply at the front end. So again, this is something that like with sponsored access in the US, where brokers provided institutions with access to the equities market, and they had to have certain controls to be able to assess the risk and et cetera, as these entities would access the market just basically through an API. Like they would just get access and the reporting would go back through the broker dealer. That same model could also be applied here, where you could effectively facilitate access to these services, but you could also apply some risk controls in terms of just pure transaction risk, like exposure risks, or if something's going on that there's through an Oracle or a live Oracle, you mitigate that risk through cutting off or reducing, and it's dynamic. So all these things could be implemented. In terms of the risk for the retail investor, I think if you implemented all of these things, I think you substantially reduce the risk. Now, the complete ecosystem that an institutional investor that's regulating the U.S. could actually access through these types of controls would be much more limited than we have today, right? Because I would hope that institutions aren't going to be using this to trade bonk or something like that. But certainly, you know, you could certainly start with the blue chips. And even that would be something that I think would be beneficial to the market and start to improve the controls, probably establish more benchmark standards, particularly for security. I think if you start to reward and provide those benchmark controls, then at least you have a standard that others can start to endeavor to achieve. And if you encourage that institutional access, I think it would really benefit the whole industry.
Yeah. For a variety of reasons that you allude to in the paper as well. And last question for you, Eric, on this paper, and I've spoken with you throughout the process of writing it, and it was quite a lift. And I can imagine you learned an exceptional amount. But when you think back on what you learned from writing this paper, what your takeaways have been, anything come to mind to you that changed the way you think about either securities regulation, DeFi, or the intersection between the two?
I think one of the things that's challenging in writing the paper is, like, I can't say that I've got it all figured out. And I don't think you should ever trust anybody who says that they have. But there's a cross-section that kind of believe in this, like, hybrid finance world and want to preserve that core DeFi core. Because once it all comes under the state, then once you start mandating intermediaries, there is no DeFi. And I'd say one thing that did change for me is just how real that really was. And like, I think I referenced how, like, initially I called it hybrid DeFi, and then Gabe Shapiro was like, no, it's not. And then we went back and forth about what to call it. And it's like, it's hybrid finance. And then, like, it really would dawned on me how right that perspective was. And it's what I meant, but it's the words are important, because hybrid DeFi is not DeFi. It's right. The minute you put in the hybrid, you can put hybrid finance on top of DeFi, and as long as you preserve that DeFi core, okay. But so I think it's something that is under attack. It seems like going into, like, the IOSCO letters and everything else, and even seeing how the CFTC is approaching it and such, people are saying DeFi is great, but we need to have intermediaries. DeFi is great, but it's an enterprise. And I feel like that's what we're fighting for. And I think there's a pathway. And I think, why not take the pathway? Why not try to work something out? Why not create something that, even if it fails, some great technologies, some great solutions could come out of it that benefits everybody. And maybe it's the basis for which we build the next thing. So anyway, I don't know if it's my epiphany, but that's something that really resonates with me as I think about what the paper points to and the direction that we ultimately have to take. Because there's an opportunity to get this right, and we're not taking that opportunity.
Yeah, and it will be interesting to see how things shake out over the next couple of years. There are a few bills that are in different stages, so it will be really interesting to see how things shape up over the next few years, and I'm sure you will be a big part of it, Eric. So thank you for joining me today and for the work you've done with the paper, too. I enjoyed reading it and having the conversations with you.
Thanks so much, Jacob.